Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, May 15, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on whether major changes are coming in compelled speech, dealing with conflict minerals, meat labeling, and more. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we welcome two expert attorneys. The first is Wiley Ryan partner Megan Brown, and the second is sole practitioner Eric Jaffe. More complete bios of both speakers were provided to you in advance of the call, so I'll stop there to preserve more time for their presentations, discussions, and your questions. So to go ahead and start us off, I'm going to turn it over to Megan Brown, who's going to give us an overview and start the discussion. So Megan, the floor is yours.
Great, thank you. We're here today to discuss the state of play on the First Amendment as it applies to what we'll call mandatory corporate speech or compelled disclosures. Federal, state, and local governments are increasingly looking to impose various informational obligations on private companies and industries, everything from labeling of genetically modified organism containing foods to calorie labeling to name and shame demands like the conflict minerals rule we'll discuss in a bit. The governments offer little in the way of limiting principle and invoke public safety, health, economic, and social policy and include the consumer's nebulous right to know. As these obligations have increased, businesses started to push back, and a pair of cases in the D.C. Circuit asks exactly what interest the government has to be advancing in order to impose these sorts of obligations on the private sector. The en banc D.C. Circuit will address next week, actually, what leeway the government has to force private parties to engage in this sort of speech, an issue that may well end up at the Supreme Court in short order. By way of background, just to refresh sort of the seminal case in the Supreme Court on mandatory disclosures that we'll be talking about a lot today is Zouderer versus Office of Disciplinary Counsel. There, the Supreme Court upheld Ohio's punishment of a contingent fee attorney who his ads failed to disclose that the client might have to bear certain expenses. The court had determined that without the extra information, clients would be misled. The Supreme Court did not apply heightened scrutiny there because the disclosures were, quote, purely factual and uncontroversial information, and they were, quote, reasonably related to the state's interest in preventing deception. So the Zouderer standard is sometimes referred to as a rational basis test and is often described as an exception to the more traditional heightened First Amendment scrutiny, even applicable to commercial speech. Since Zouderer, courts have disagreed about whether its lower standard applies only when the government is correcting misleading speech or whether it can be used more broadly to justify compelled speech that serves varied interests from consumer curiosity to economic and social policy. That brings us to the current litigation in the D.C. Circuit. Recently, two panels of the D.C. Circuit have issued contradictory opinions. National Association of Manufacturers, or NAM, versus the SEC invalidated disclosures about so-called conflict minerals, while American Meat Institute versus the Department of Agriculture upheld a meat labeling regime applying Zouderer. So we'll take those first in turn briefly, and then we'll sort of go to the discussion, and Eric will share some of his perspectives as well. In the meat case, as we'll call it, some parts of the meat industry challenged country of origin labeling promulgated by the Agricultural Marketing Service. Under the new regime, those producers have to state on the label each country where meat was born, raised, and slaughtered, which is more detailed than previously required. The industry says this, coupled with some operational changes required, violates the statute and the First Amendment by unlawfully compelling speech. For today's purposes, we're going to leave aside some of the APA-type issues that are raised in the meat case and in conflict minerals. The D.C. Circuit disagreed with the Meat Institute and upheld the labels. They were okay with the idea that the government need not be pursuing protecting consumers from deception, but that they could have a legitimate interest in arming consumers with additional information that they just might find useful when purchasing food. The court had theorized that the information might help consumers act on patriotic or protectionist tendencies, but as AMI pointed out, other circuit cases previously have recognized that consumer curiosity alone isn't a legitimate government interest that justifies forcing a party to speak against their will. The court was clear that correcting deception is not required for Zouderer to apply. This is a departure from earlier circuit cases and an issue that is hotly disputed in the upcoming en banc. Perhaps recognizing that its approach was new, the panel dropped a footnote in that opinion saying that reasonable judges might read D.C. Circuit precedent to require deception, so they suggested en banc review, and lo and behold, just a few days later, the en banc court sua sponte took up the question. The very particular question, whether an interest in preventing deception is required in order to trigger Zouderer, that's the question that will be argued en banc next week. The other case that's going on that impacts that case or may be impacted by that case is NAM versus the SEC, the conflict minerals rule. That has the more colorful mandatory disclosure, the meat labeling not being quite as sexy or interesting as the conflict-free disclosure. Congress, in enacting this requirement, was concerned that conflict minerals being traded by armed groups were financing conflict and a humanitarian crisis in the Congo. So they pursued what litigants are calling a name and shame approach in the Dodd-Frank law. I'll vastly oversimplify, but a regulated company has to look closely at its supply chain to try and trace the origins of four minerals extracted from eastern Congo. They have to disclose whether minerals used in their products originated in the Congo or in adjoining countries. If the company can't confirm that its products are free of trace amounts, even very small amounts, it must describe its products as not found to be conflict-free in both a report to the SEC and on its website. Businesses sued, asserting, among other things, that being forced to describe their products in this arguably pejorative manner is a compulsion of speech in violation of their First Amendment rights. They argued strict scrutiny should apply because the message is political. They also argued that it failed intermediate scrutiny because the SEC had no substantial evidence that they would actually be advancing their cause of promoting peace in the Congo. The parties fought about whether the Zouderer relaxed standard would apply, with the government claiming a broad use of Zouderer for any factual disclosures, regardless of the basis for them. So, shortly before en banc was ordered in the meat case, the conflict minerals case was decided. The panel said the businesses were right on the First Amendment. They found Zouderer was inapplicable because here there was no interest in preventing deception of consumers. They also said that forcing a company to, quote, confess blood on its hands was not factual and uncontroversial, which is another key element of Zouderer. The court found the rule failed intermediate scrutiny, didn't decide whether strict scrutiny might apply, so I think that door may still be open in the long term. D.C. Circuit Judge Srinivasan was on this panel as well as the panel in the meat case. He objected to their addressing of the First Amendment while the en banc court was considering it. So it's clear that this is teed up for the en banc court. There's been some activity in the conflict minerals case. The plaintiffs there sought a stay of the other portions of the rule because the SEC and they have been debating what parts of it will be enforced come June 2nd, which is right around the corner. They lost that request for an emergency stay yesterday. The conflict minerals plaintiffs, demonstrating the interplay between these two cases, filed an amicus brief in the meat case, supporting their view of Zouderer, and also laying down a marker that even if the en banc court expands Zouderer beyond prevention of deception, the conflict minerals disclosures should still fail because they are far from purely factual and uncontroversial. So that's the overall lay of the land with these two cases and how they have interacted to get to this en banc showdown next week. A few quick observations before Eric jumps in. There are obviously lots of interesting doctrinal questions buried in here, but the big picture is a real battle over the proper role of government in shaping public policy and trying to affect consumer choice through what may look like innocuous disclosure obligations and under the auspices of sort of more information always being better. Often it is hard to get a good vehicle to litigate some of these issues. Either the product or its history is unsympathetic, as in as the courts seem to take the view in a lot of the tobacco First Amendment cases, or the imposition itself just doesn't seem terribly onerous. The disclosure seems very minimal. But in my view, if the en banc court dispenses with the deception requirement, I think we're going to see a lot more of these seemingly innocuous disclosure obligations pop up as a manner to, as a way to try and shape the market and push consumers and public policy in a particular direction. But lots to talk about and look forward to what Eric has to say.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate being here, both with you on the panel and for the Federal Society. A couple observations about both of these cases. First of all, the very notion that in either case we're even fighting about Zotterer, and particularly fighting about the deception point of Zotterer, seems laughable, given that, of course, these are not uncontroversial. They may well be factual, but they're controversial facts. They're facts that, by the very point that the government is trying to make people reveal them, demonstrate that they are part of a ongoing public debate, and whether you want to characterize it as a public policy debate, whether you want to characterize it as a humanitarian debate, or even just as the sort of jingoistic tendencies or, you know, anti-free trade tendencies of the American public. These are not uncontroversial in the way that I think Zotterer meant it. So the fact that this debate is happening suggests that we're already drifting meaningfully away from a sensible view of the First Amendment. Not that I think Zotterer is a sensible view. I actually think it's far too lenient. But you know, the whole point is, obviously with conflict minerals, that's pretty clear on its face. The name and shame is, I think, an apt description of it. The only reason in the world the government is forcing them to put this information is because they think it will shame both the manufacturers from producing the product that has these goods in it, and it will shame people who would otherwise buy it from buying a product that it has on its label. You're helping kill kids in the Congo, and you're helping with a war. You know, I find that self-evident. The made in the USA stuff is a little more mixed, in that there are certainly some instances where I think the government might have a reasonable interest in sort of country of origin things. Take, for example, situations where certain countries don't have the safety and health practices that we have, and so the food might be tainted. But the certainty of that is not so great that you would necessarily ban it. But you would certainly want to, you might well want to give consumers a choice. I don't want to eat grapes from Chile. I'd rather eat grapes in the U.S. because they use pesticides there that are not allowed here. You can see health and safety interests perhaps backing up certain aspects of country of origin. But what's going on here, I don't think that's really the argument being made for the meat rule. What in fact is being made, and I think what is in fact behind this, is the simple jingoism of, if it has more USA in the label, you're more likely to buy it. And if it's made, if it's born, raised, and slaughtered elsewhere, you're going to look at that cross-eyed because, of course, good Americans don't buy foreign beef, supposedly. And so it's that very, very much a speech and persuasive aspect of the rule that I think triggers a full-blown First Amendment inquiry, not merely this watered-down substitute that Zotterer suggests in the case of lawyers. One of the ways to understand some of this, I think, is to sort of ask, why is it that Zotterer did what it did, and how is it that it could do it? How is it that Zotterer can say forced disclosure of facts, regardless of whether they're controversial or not, is somehow subject to lower scrutiny? And the answer to that question, as I think the answer to many commercial speech-related questions, is that commercial speech is often a mixture of speech and conduct. So take the simplest example of an offer to enter into a contract. That is both speech and a speech act, much like in the draft card burning case of U.S. versus O'Brien. Burning the draft card was both speech and an act. It was conduct and speech mixed together. It had an expressive component, but it had conduct as well. And so is the same case when you make an offer to sell something, for example. It is both speech and conduct. And that's why we have commercial speech rules that give a little flexibility. It's to regulate the conduct component of that, not the persuasive or speech component of that. And so that when you then look at Zotterer and ask, why is it that deception matters because even under traditional contract law, if you gave a deceptive offer, it would arguably void the contract. It would give remedies to make it voidable potentially. So there are all kinds of things that would undermine the contractual aspect of that based upon false speech, that the government has a legitimate interest in regulating or at least in addressing after the fact, whereas if it were simply persuasive information, not key to the contract itself, or let's say it was political information, you would think the government would have no interest in that. So I agree that these cases sort of open the door for far broader compelled disclosures in situations where the disclosure is in fact not related to the conduct per se or the act component of the speech, but is in fact related to something else, related to the government's persuasive agenda, related to sort of consumer prejudice in favor of the United States products, for example. But you can just as easily imagine a law that says consumers very much want to know who the owners of companies donate their money to. And so you're going to have to disclose on your product whether you are supporting Democrats or Republicans. And, you know, Zauderer, of course, would call that controversial, but I don't see how it's any more controversial than the conflict minerals point if it's in fact going to influence consumer choice and we want to deter people from buying products from Republicans. Then why not have them label their product? You know, this is a Republican made product. It's not Republican free, just like it's not conflict mineral free, and consequently make your own choices, U.S. public. And you could spin the scenarios, obviously, the hypotheticals on that version can spin in a dozen ways. Is your workplace lesbian, gay, and bisexual friendly? Do you provide health insurance for gay couples? You have to label all of that because lots of people might want to make purchasing choices based on whether they agree or disagree with your corporate policies. We could pick any one of them that Congress one day thinks is meaningful and force you to disclose that. And just so that we don't look like we're picking on the Democrats, you know, don't forget that McCarthy started all this and that we wanted to just, you know, you could imagine a disclosure that says, do you have any communists on your board? Because who would want to buy from a commie? And of course, the Go USA stuff, I think, is probably plenty of Republicans supporting that as well. So it cuts both ways politically, but I think it's a horrible precedent to suddenly allow consumer information about things that the government thinks they ought to be thinking about to drive government regulation of speech as a legitimate interest. I don't even think it's a question of whether it's substantial. I actually think it's affirmatively illegitimate that government tries to balance out the flow of information in the market, or more importantly, imbalance the flow of information in the market into a direction that they think will influence consumer choice. That, of course, is not the role of government, and the First Amendment, I think, its very existence makes that clear. It's not simply about forbidding views, but it could just as easily be about elevating views that you want to drown out other views. And, of course, in this instance, I think the conflict minerals point might easily drown out meaningful other pieces of information that consumers would otherwise care about. So the question is, where do you go? You know, because some of these interests, you can imagine the government might well have a legitimate interest in drying up resources to the bad folks in the Congo. I suppose the government has some legitimate interest in promoting U.S. Trade and U.S. products. And, of course, they could always regulate to do that rather than control speech. They could ban the use of minerals that come from the Congo, and then manufacturers would have to investigate whether or not their minerals came from the Congo, therefore whether they're violating laws. We embargo countries all the time, and I don't see that as being a speech issue, and it certainly would effectuate the government's basic point, which is to deter money from going to the Congo. One wonders why that fact in and of itself isn't enough to make this an undue burden on speech that is more than necessary to achieve the government's interest when they have such an obvious regulatory option available to them. And cases like that are, you know, if you recall the old case of Posadas where they tried to ban advertising of gambling, even though gambling was legal, the answer in that case was no, the greater power to ban something does not include the lesser power to manipulate speech about that thing. And I think the same should be true here. You could ban conflict minerals, but I don't think you ought to have the option of just, you know, forcing everyone to wear the scarlet letter of shame about whether they use such minerals. The final thing I'll say on this point is that, of course, if these were really meaningful to the American public, the simplest way to do that, of course, would be for them to demand information from the companies themselves and say, you know, have consumers say we'd be more willing to buy products without conflict minerals, just like you see people saying we're more willing to buy products without cholesterol, we're more willing to buy products that are organic, that are raised in a friendly manner, and plenty of companies voluntarily label their products to respond to that consumer demand for information. And I think that's the more sensible way for the market to work rather than have it government-driven, which is, of course, the same as saying the government is now manipulating what's important to consumer choice rather than consumers themselves declaring what's important to their choice. As for predictions, you know, I am pessimistic that the D.C. Circuit will get this right. The balance on that court is not great. I don't think they have an overwhelming track record of being First Amendment friendly, though I will say they occasionally show sparks of that, which, you know, gives me at least some hope. But if I had to predict, I would say 60-40, they're going to say this does not violate the First Amendment, in large part because of a overly lenient view of the commercial speech doctrine and of Zotterer and of the sort of doctrinal reasons why the government can get away with this in the first place. Before we start picking on the D.C. Circuit too much, of course, much of the blame for that lies within the U.S. Supreme Court, some of their older decisions that were less than speech-friendly, though I think this case would have a better chance today at the U.S. Supreme Court than it does at the D.C. Circuit. So perhaps we'll just have to wait and see when it goes up. That's all for now, and we can sort of go back and forth a bit or take questions. But hopefully that provided enough to get the conversation rolling.
Megan, do you have any thoughts on Eric's comments?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with a good bit of what he said. I mean, I think what resounded was the discussion of why they don't ban these things. That would be, I think, the more politically costly decision. And in a way, I think that the speech manipulation is a very low-cost way to achieve public policy by sort of conscripting or dragooning the private sector into passing along their messaging. If they perceive there's a market failure, there's some sort of problem with not enough people caring to really facilitate or demand certain kinds of information or certain action from an industry, it's a heck of a lot easier to pass something under the rubric of the right to know than to actually ban something like a mineral that is critical to certain industries or genetically modified organisms in the food supply. It's much safer to do that, but it, in that sense, is a bit more pernicious because it reduces the barriers to government action by making it a lower cost avenue. So that's why I think you'll tend to see these types of obligations pop up, is because it enables them to feel like they're moving a lever on public policy. It may indeed help move a lever by raising awareness about a pet issue or something they find relevant without having to take the big bite of actually legislating or regulating substantively, where you can't get consensus on banning something or regulating it. Having more information and invoking, sort of inverting the First Amendment's interest in the free flow of information is useful to you. It's a very low-cost move there. And similarly, I think there are interesting questions about, you know, Eric talks about health and safety interests and how there are certainly areas where I think most people don't get too squeamish about the required production of information relating to health and safety. But then the interesting question becomes sort of what level of proof is required and what's the burden on the government to justify those health and safety interests, particularly in a time when, well, not like today's any different, but when science changes over time and scientific consensus can evolve, what burden will the government be put to articulate a real health and safety issue or a real environmental issue as opposed to something speculative or like the precautionary principle, which certain governments have invoked? So they're, to me, very interesting questions, but it's a lot about the government offloading its obligations to do its homework and gather up the kind of consensus that would be needed to do something more impactful that's also a higher political cost to them, such as banning conflict minerals, as he mentioned, or banning genetically modified organisms, and where the regulator sort of knows that that's implausible or impossible or would be counterproductive. They can impose an informational obligation that sort of scratches that itch. It feels good because it's the consumer's right to know, and then they can move on and use the market, in a sense, the language of the market, to validate what they're doing, which is, you know, sort of manipulating and tweaking the market, but under the auspices of promoting information to the market. So it's really about the burden and the government being allowed to offload that burden and not have to amass the kind of substantial evidence that one would normally expect before they can do that.
You know, I agree entirely, actually. It's really quite an interesting perversion of the constitutional structure, the way this ends up working. So the very reason we have sort of a lower scrutiny of economic and basic straight-up regulation, non-speech regulation, is because it is costly. It requires some effort. It has consequences. It has material consequences. And so the framers, I think, rightly understood that passing those things, A, would be difficult, and B, would create its own counterbalance if it created problems that would cause political pressure to either repeal it or to not do it in the first place. And so they're not going to spend a lot of time with the Constitution because they understood that the political checks, the practical checks on those kind of behavior, were more than sufficient in a democracy. Regulating speech, of course, is easy. It's often unseen. It's misperceived as not having any expense or any meaningful cost, though, of course, in these cases, it has quite a big material cost. But in general, regulating speech, especially when you're sort of forcing people to speak, doesn't cost the government very much money at all. And so you don't have the usual objections that you would have in sort of material conduct-based regulation. But that's precisely why you need a higher standard of scrutiny, because it is so easy for the government to do it without a lot of pushback. The Constitution provides its own pushback, understanding that the political pressures don't work as well when you try to regulate speech, particularly in a jingoistic environment, let's say, or an environment where public opinion is swaying in one direction, though not perhaps enough to impose costly regulations, but more than enough that people are not going to stand up and object to a speech regulation themselves. So I think she's exactly right. And in fact, we've seen this happen over the years. If you just think about tobacco advertising, and especially the forced ads that tobacco companies had to pay for about why tobacco is terrible and miserable and makes your teeth rot and kills you and gives you terrible lungs. If you look in California and they had those ads, they couldn't actually ban cigarettes. They couldn't get the folks to do that. So what they instead did is they went on an advertising campaign to make everybody hate cigarettes. And once that campaign succeeded, then they could start banning it more and more and more. And that's exactly why we have the First Amendment, the danger of sort of priming the pump or, prepping the battlefield, if you will, with sort of government-manipulated information to then let them get around the political hurdles to conduct. I think the level of proof on all of these should at a minimum be intermediate scrutiny, but quite frankly, I think it should be higher in a lot of these instances where you're not regulating the conduct or mixed speech and conduct, but you're only regulating information. I think that arguably it should be higher where that information is not somehow central to the formation of the contract itself. The terms of the contract itself, much in my view of sort of how commercial speech ought to be viewed. And that would be true even for health and safety stuff, because I agree the government is notoriously inept at figuring out what is helpful and what is safe, and half the time their advice is exactly the opposite of the reality that they discovered 20 years later. And so you certainly want to give them a free pass to do that. This raises another question, of course, which is, I suppose in any of these instances, the government arguably could just take general revenues and process this information itself and disseminate this information itself. If you believe folks like Justice Scalia, there's essentially no restrictions on government speech. And so if the government wants to sort of force you to figure out whether they're, as part of its regulatory task, where do your minerals come from, and then it publishes the information, presumably that doesn't raise a First Amendment question under today's doctrine. And I think that's wrong. I think even government speech, even direct government speech, to the extent that it is meant to be informational or persuasive, should be scrutinized under the First Amendment just like any kind of compelled support for speech would be. And so that's something we should all think about, because at the end of the day, even if the First Amendment wins in this fight, the government will just do it itself and force folks to carry the government label on it, just like cigarettes have to carry a government tax stamp and a government warning.
And I guess, you know, to follow up on that, I'm not as uncomfortable as Eric is with government speech as a concept. In fact, as a litigation strategy or a real legal point to judges, it's a very powerful argument to say, you know, you can't satisfy least restrictive means when you conscript someone else because without the presence of existing misleading commercial speech that you're just modifying by sticking a disclaimer on it. When you actually have an affirmative sort of disclosure obligation or messaging obligation, it's, I think, powerful to respond and say, well, if the government feels strongly about this and if it in some sense reflects the will of the population to have access to certain kinds of information or messaging or awareness or education, the government is well within its rights to do that and can does that and has done that. In fact, you see it in the tobacco setting. The, you know, Health and Human Services has a multi-million dollar ad campaign that they've put up, and I think that's a useful place to go when you're a private company saying, you know, okay, you think conflict minerals are important or you think GMOs are important. You do it, and at least there you'd have the moderate political check of they'd have to get the will to expend the money, as opposed to being able to just grab some poor private sector entity and make them carry that water for them. So it's a good litigation, not tactic, but it's a useful argument to have to say make them do it if they feel this strongly about it. Don't have the costless sleight of hand by making me carry their water for them. One other thing. Go ahead, Eric.
No. Oh, I was going to say, I agree with you that it is, at the moment, it's a sort of at least a short-run victory in litigation strategy, but we've seen the same strategy in other contexts, for example, campaign finance, where for many years, folks on the First Amendment side would say, oh, disclosure is enough. You don't need to regulate. You don't need to restrict speech. You can just force disclosure about where the money came from or something like that. And that is coming back to bite us on the rear end, as they've discovered that disclosure indeed is quite effective. And if we make you disclosure donors and if we make folks disclose who they gave money to, the crazies in the public will take care of the rest. And so who needs to regulate it when you have people willing to protest your house and bomb your car and threaten your business to shutting your business down? While I agree it sort of wins the battle, I'm not sure it wins the war at the end of the day, because I don't think the government will be as shy about going ahead and doing this themselves if they can't make you do it. And the way they've historically done this, of course, is not from general revenues where the tax burden is then spread out on everyone, but with special fees on whatever industry it is that you're sort of dumping on today. And those have unfortunately been routinely upheld by the Supreme Court as legitimate, even though to me they strike me just like compelled support for speech that you disagree with. So the most recent case is Livestock Marketing Association, where a tax on the beef industry forced the beef, was used to pay for advertisements that the Supreme Court determined were government speech, even though that decision was questionable because it said brought to you by the Beef Council. Nobody imagined it was the government, but apparently it's government speech anyway, paid for by the beef producers and passed on to consumers in a way that they never really notice. So while I agree that there's a potential check there, I think the government has been pretty clever at getting around those kinds of checks in the past, and I am not optimistic that the law will keep up with them or care in the future.
Although one virtue of that sort of exaction and targeted forced speech or forced support for speech is at least the victims of it are more willing to get in the ring. One of the things, and litigate these cases, one of the things I observe in watching these things percolate and these ballot measures come up on various issues that the right to know might want to vindicate, it can be very difficult for the private sector to try and take on some of these informational obligations. And that's something you see. I think there's more appetite in the past few years because both the predicate for the disclosures and the type of disclosures have gotten more aggressive. So you've seen businesses say, okay, this goes too far. But it is often difficult to stand up and fight against the nebulous consumer right to know. When we were litigating in the San Francisco cell phone warning case, right, that was the drumbeat we heard repeatedly is look at industry that wants to stand in the way of the free flow of information and prevent people from getting information. So I do think those sort of forced collective marketing for an industry at least have the virtue, if not the big picture win, the virtue of known winners and losers who at least can put their skin in the game and fight about it, as opposed to the more nebulous and harder to combat broad conscriptions under the sort of consumer right to know sort of approach that apply very broadly and can be very difficult politically to get the will to actually combat in court.
I think that's a fair point, that having larger entities be the target of these things and the ones bearing the costs will at a minimum sort of increase their inclination to make a political fuss about it, and hence might make it a little harder to pass some of these. Yeah. So on many of these, what you end up having very weird coalitions of people who think that they can control the message, coercing their competitors into supporting a message that helps one faction but hurts the other. That's sort of what you see in the agricultural marketing world,
mm-hmm.
is that it's always a factionalized fight with a good chunk of the folks in the industry actually supporting the program because they know it helps them and hurts their competitors. And so there's a very weird dynamic when you start having businesses forcing their peers to speak in a certain way. And you see that, quite frankly, in EPA-related things also, right? Anybody who has a solar plant or a natural gas plant now wants coal regulated up, to high heaven because they know it's going to hose their competitors, not because they want EPA regulation per se. And in terms of them being willing to litigate, I agree that it's nice that in some ways government has gone that route because it has triggered a lot of litigation, but that only matters if we win. So if we litigate for years and then the courts duck, it doesn't get us very far. So hopefully, the government takes that strategy, but the courts then do their part in actually answering the lawsuits of the victims of this, the corporate victims, even though they're not very sympathetic, I suppose, and sort of saying, no, they still have their First Amendment rights, and this goes too far. If that's the outcome, I'll agree. If the courts abdicate at the end of the day, I'm not sure where it's gotten us, and maybe it's sort of laid a roadmap for the government to do things that they might not otherwise have done directly.
Yeah, well, we can see from the briefing in various cases that various governments are chomping at the bit, and I don't think will want for creativity if the Zouderer question comes out the wrong way. Another interesting aspect of the D.C. Circuit fight is, the regulatory agencies the D.C. Circuit has the lion's share of regulatory appeals, and so to the extent that the D.C. Circuit signals that an interest in deception is no longer a gating mechanism to the very relaxed approach under Zouderer, I think you could see a lot more agency attempts, which are even more removed from the political process, of course, to extract information and force disclosures and informational sharing without as much of a burden. And at the end of the day, it's not as if all of these are just going to sail through the courts. The right thing could be challenged under the rest of Zouderer if deception is removed as a precondition. But I think it just makes it that much easier for them to paper and to try and build their record and get the predicates satisfied. So I think you will see more agencies dipping their toe in these waters than previously had been playing in this space of saying, oh, well, this is a nice idea. Let's make this regulated entity put this on its product or say this or put this on its website or tell me, the regulator, about various and sundry product attributes, product uses, characteristics of the company, et cetera. So I do think you'll see more there if they open that door wider.
I absolutely agree. I think this is not even the nose in the camel's nose in the tent. This is, the camel's whole front quarter coming in, and the rest of it's sure to follow. I like to think of the rest of government as the camels behind, and I'm sure they'll act accordingly. Is this a good time for questions? I don't know if we have questions from the listeners.
Yeah, this is Christian. I think if you two are ready, we can. We've got a number of people on the call. I can open up to questions. Just a quick reminder to those of you on the call. We had quite a few of you join late. We apologize that our reminder email went out late. Our website had some technical difficulties, but just a reminder, if you missed the beginning of the call, This teleform, as well as almost all of our other ones, will be posted as podcasts on our website. So in 24 to 48 hours, you can go to the website, and if you missed the beginning of the call, you can get caught up there. But in a moment, we'll open the floor to questions. You'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on, and after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. So again, it's star and the pound key. It looks like we got one question jumping on the line right away, and we'll go right to it.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. What do you think about the viability of making some originalist arguments in cases of this kind? By original understanding, commerce consisted only of trade in tangible commodities mediated by a merchant. Power to regulate them included the power to require certain labeling, but it was the original understanding that this power could only be exercised at state borders and not at the point of manufacture or at the point of retail sales. So it would certainly not include advertising or posting something on one's website. The only other compelled speech would be as a witness in a case or in a deposition during a discovery process. Due process doesn't allow any other option.
Sure. So as a positive matter, I think the chances are zero. To have originalist arguments of that. Certainly the chances of that in the D.C. Circuit are absolutely zero. In fact, I think they're probably negative. Making such an argument would hurt your case more than help it. In the Supreme Court, I think they probably just rise back up to the level of zero. If just recalling the Obamacare fight, the fight is not about whether commerce was what we thought it was in the 1700s and whether it stops at state borders. We're so far over that bridge, we're so far past that no one, not even the most conservative justice, is thinking of going back in that direction. They just want a tighter connection, but no one's going to ask for that. And advertising is such a predominant part of the economy these days that I think there will be no instance in which we cease to think of it as commerce.
All right. Well, we've got two more pending questions, so we'll go right away to them. Again, if you'd like to get in line to ask a question, press star and then the pound key.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks. This is a great discussion. Earlier in the discussion, I'm sorry, my name is Don Padu. I'm a lawyer in California. Earlier in the discussion, Megan talked about the government dragooning the private sector. And I wonder if you have any thoughts when it goes the other way. And I'll give you a quick concrete example so we know what we're talking about. Winemakers can say on their bottle labels where the wine is from, Napa County, Sonoma County, but only if the area is a American Vintners Association area. So a winemaker, for example, in Calaveras County, California, can't say their wine is from Calaveras County. They have to say their wine is from the Sierra foothills. And you can imagine the fights that happen within the Vintners Association about, you know, who gets to claim what. And the way it gets enforced is winemakers have to get their labels approved every year by the TTB, by the government. And I have a number of clients who want to say their wine is where it's from, and it doesn't happen to be an American Vintners Association approved name, so they can't say it.
So I guess you're sort of asking what options they have or how they would go about trying to get out of this pickle. I mean, you know, when you look at FTC and a lot of the speech regulation, such as it is that's out there, this to me is why deception is so important to Zouderer. It is a concept that, you know, Eric and I were discussing earlier offline. the FTC gets a huge assist in the concept of mislabeling and misbranding, and there's almost a real reluctance to even look behind that. I think, you know, there's an argument that maybe the FTC and states in a similar position should have to do more. But to me, in that situation, I'm inferring that it's predicated in some sense on the idea that there's been a determination that one way is an accurate way to label or brand and another would be arguably erroneous, and that's how they're going about that. And I think that highlights that's how the FDA does a lot of its stuff. It's through the lens, through the rubric of misbranding and mislabeling. So they've already grabbed on to the deception issue and the sort of consumer protection piece and are already in sort of a different posture. If that makes sense.
Well,
Eric?
They aren't making the deception argument, the government, because, you know, the wine is actually produced in Amador County or Calaveras County. The argument the TTB makes is to put on a label where the wine is made is a sign to the consumer that it is a premium product. And you know, it's like saying extra special good. And the government says, we want the trade association, the Vintners Association, to define, you know, who can say that their wine is extra special good by putting on the label where it's from. So they haven't even gone to the deception argument. It's this.
Have there been First Amendment challenges to this? Because, I mean, it strikes me as so, assuming that the label is in fact accurate, this strikes me sort of right in the teeth of the First Amendment.
Yeah, well, you guys hit the nail on the head in another part of your discussion. You know, these entities are really highly regulated, and they want me to find a way to allow them to do this without having to litigate, because they're afraid if they bring a lawsuit, the regulator will come and make their life miserable.
Well, and then you've just hit the nail on the head, which is it's now not about what the law says or might say or would say in the proper case. It's about entities being cowed by their regulators and hence not raising the issue. So is there a way to get around your regulator when you're unwilling to challenge them? Probably not.
Well, and keep in mind, when you have a substantively and heavily regulated industry or product, it's a much easier putt for the government to be able to explain why its view of labeling or accuracy in labeling or the comprehensive regulatory regime is aided by this. And my guess is they have a better shot at teasing out their substantial interest and the rational relationship between the means and the ends when you're already in a world of heavy regulation where they're already getting deference on calling the shots about other product attributes, and they may say what's important to this overall regulatory scheme that certain things be disclosed or the market be run in certain areas. My inference on the wine industry is there's a variety of economic and product regulations that the TTB is also administering, and it wouldn't be difficult for them to attach that sort of restriction to one of those other interests and be able to make it work.
You know, there's a lot of accuracy and truth to that you know, they can piggyback so much on their otherwise sort of free-flowing ad law discretion. I mean, you see this with the FTC quite a bit, where, you know, the FTC is given such deference in defining what is and isn't deceptive without any evidence whatsoever to back them up. It's just considered their interpretive discretion of what an ad will be read to mean. I think that's a shame, actually. I think talk about speech regulators with nobody watching watching the foxes in the hen house. But yes, it's a problem. I didn't mean to suggest that this would actually win a lawsuit. It's just that I think it clearly violates the First Amendment, but the courts, of course, are notorious in their inability to see the First Amendment in certain types of contexts, and ad law-based contexts, regulated product-based contexts, happen to be the most common situations where courts, I think, fall down on their duty and just ignore what would otherwise be a very straightforward First Amendment issue. But unless somebody tries, we'll never know, I suppose, is the short answer to that.
Thank you.
All right, looks like we've got at least one more question on the line that we can get to.
Hi, my name is Andy Karkstrom. I'm an attorney here in Washington, D.C. I was wondering, you were discussing about, I think one of the obvious underpinnings here is how unsympathetic the clients are when you have big, rich, for-profit corporations, you know, especially when they want to exploit, you know, minerals that are funding an immoral war in Africa. But what about when these types of things start coming down on more sympathetic clients, or in more traditional speech, I think, circles? For example, right now you have the pregnancy crisis centers, I think in New York and in Maryland, that are being told they have to post certain things in their, you know, in their lobbies. Or what if food labeling regulations came down on soup kitchens and things like that, where you might have, I think, a different class of plaintiffs?
I think, you know, the crisis pregnancy center cases are being litigated, and I haven't followed the most recent iterations of that. But my hunch is if the state defenders of those obligations are being smart, they're building a predicate of deception, that there is a market. Now, I'm sure you have antecedent commercial speech questions about, is a crisis pregnancy center even a commercial actor? And I won't bite on that at this point. I'm curious how the courts might come out on that if they haven't already addressed it. But to the extent they're in a market, and you're assuming they're promoting a service of some sort, they'd be smart to build a record that says whatever they're doing is deceptive. But that's why the deception part of Zouderer and these burden allocations are important to hold the government to its obligation to build its record and to actually have a real problem that it is actually trying to address, not a speculative or political agenda that they're trying to push. And obviously, administrative or congressional records are manipulable, but that's how I would advise a state, and that's where I think it would probably be vulnerable from the flip side. If you're imposing additional informational obligations, and I think what they do is they say, you know, you have to also say that you don't provide abortion services and things of that nature. So that's one sort of off-the-cuff response to how that litigation could shake out. And I forget I've lost track of the second piece of your question.
Well, looks like
the second part was just what if hypothetically there was, you know, soup kitchens being forced to label their food?
I mean, I think you'd have, and Eric, feel free to jump in, but you'd be in the sort of police power area of probably a state or local government to provide regular health and safety obligations, and it depends on, I guess, what the label would say. In all likelihood, being realistic about how a scenario would play out. If it's, you know, here, put a disclosure that says certain things about making life choices and finding God or whatever, I think you're going to have courts looking at that differently than if it's labeling of food or attributes of what they're giving out.
Yeah, I mean, you can easily imagine even a soup kitchen being told you have to tell your patrons whether there are tree nuts in your food or if it's gluten-free. There's enough of a health hook there that I imagine something like that would probably survive, just because it is a straight-up health and safety question. It's not even sort of one of these nebulous questions. If you're allergic to nuts, you're allergic to nuts, and you would hope that somebody might mention that there's nuts in the soup. But in general, I think the bigger point you make is, you know, what happens with sympathetic clients, and I agree that sympathetic clients would tend to do better than unsympathetic ones. The trouble is the government knows this just as well as anybody, and that's why you have exceptions to all of these laws that carve out the folks that might actually gain sympathy. They go after the ones that are unsympathetic, they get their rulings, and then they expand the program to further and further reaches of sympathy where the case law is already against them. And so maybe it's a political issue, but it ceases to become a legal issue once you've sort of gotten your good ruling against your bad actor. And I think if you look back, it was the ACLU that really understood this and understood how to fight this, is that you can't make it about your client. You have to make it about the process and about the rules. And so the ACLU would defend the bad guys. They'd defend the incredibly unsympathetic folks because they understood that if you lost on the Nazi, you were going to lose on the conservative Christian, and then you were going to lose on the non-conservative Christian later, and that it just, it's, you know, whoever's ox is being gored just depends on the moment, and governments are smart enough to only gore someone once they have public opinion on their side. So I guess what I'd say is you got to lay it all out on the table, even for the ugly folks. At least when it comes to what the rules and the standards are, which is, I think, exactly what Megan has been saying about the burdens of proof and what government does and doesn't have to prove and how high we're going to hold them to that burden. So even if you have a bad case where the government could probably survive a higher standard, it's still worth fighting mightily to make sure that the correct standard is applied, even if the particular client ends up losing even under a more rigorous standard. And, you know, while I'm not wont to praise the ACLU these days, I think back in the 60s, they got this. They did a good job of keeping the public conscious that it wasn't about whoever the government was attacking today, because they could always attack you tomorrow.
You know, you have to choose smart cases. I wouldn't advise anyone to take some of the really mundane federal regulations that require, you know, chemical or other disclosures to court. But at the same time, you know, it's important for businesses not to go along with some of the incremental creep of some of these things, because you end up with the question that I think a lot of litigants get, you know, you didn't object to this or that or this or that, and now you're here squawking about it. And you saw that a little bit, or at least I recall the flavor of it, in some of the tobacco litigation where they had settled cases and agreed to do certain things voluntarily, and then they're being used, those voluntary agreements are used against them, or their failure to object, say, when the labels first came out, was used against them. Now, I think that's a case where the scientific evidence is pretty robust, and their lawsuit would not have won back in the day when those labels came out. But you can see the tolerance of some incremental encroachments on your First Amendment rights can make it a tougher hill to climb later if you wait for the exaction to get really, really painful. Then I think courts look at you and sort of say, well, this isn't really about principle. Where have you been for the past X number of years? And I think that's something that should counsel in favor of seriously considering laying down your markers along the way and fighting with your regulator or fighting with a state or local government, smartly, of course, because you don't want to bring loser cases. But to sort of sit and take it until it gets really, really bad makes it, I think, harder to win later.
Well, and you see this exact in one of the cases we were discussing today, the AMI, the beef labeling case. As far as I can tell, nobody's actually challenging the older version of the rules about, you know, made in the USA, not made in the USA. It's just this one got too detailed and might cost us more money to implement. That's hardly a persuasive First Amendment objection when even in the case itself you're not challenging the basic labeling requirement of, is it U.S. beef or is it Argentinian beef? You just don't like the three-tiered version of it because it's more burdensome. Well, that is exactly the incrementalism Megan talks about, and it's a terribly unpersuasive situation. We've seen this in campaign finance as well, where, you know, the reason the McConnell case came out adversely to the First Amendment is because half the litigants were conceding two-thirds of the regulations and only quibbling at the margins. Well, but once you've conceded the game, you know, wondering about how many points you lost by doesn't seem to be very productive.
Yeah, and I think litigants also face a similar but slightly different dynamic when they're challenging regulations and not the statute. And that's, I think, an increasingly popular tool of Congress is to pass a statute, and you see it in conflict minerals and other statutes where there'll be the underlying statute, and then it's the rules. It was a challenge for us in litigating the cell phone warning case out in California. There was an underlying ordinance, and the rules were what really, you know, gave the particulars to the obligation. You saw it in the, you know, the tobacco case. So this, the intrusion of the regulator here adds a layer of complexity because you have a tough decision to make. Do I attack the statute as well, which may be the harder one to take out, or do I take out the really offensive regulations but not fight on the principle of taking out the statute? And I think, you know, we see that with congressional enactments telling agencies to go forth and do good. It's hard to quarrel with that. It's really when the rubber hits the road at the agency that then you challenge it. But you need to remember to challenge and make your points and stake your ground on the statute as well.
Well, it's interesting. This is the delegation creeps back into everything, right? This is Congress ducking the costs and the burden of the political costs and the practical burden of actually having to make these choices themselves leads to sort of agency discretion, agency delegation. I wonder if there's room at some point for sort of a narrower version of the anti-delegation doctrine that sort of covers speech-sensitive topics. If Congress really wants to regulate speech, it has to go into the details. It can't just give agencies open discretion to regulate speech. I don't know whether that's been tried before, but it certainly seems like, while the full-blown version of the delegation doctrine is not coming back anytime soon, maybe a narrower one that sort of dealt with constitutionally sensitive areas might have some legs.
I think that's intriguing because you do see on some of this litigation, the agencies point back to Congress and say, well, Congress made me do it. And to a point, they're right. You sort of got this sense from the SEC's rulemaking in the conflict minerals case. They weren't happy about the task that they were given. It's a little bit out of their lane. They didn't seem to love it. Now they're defending it mightily now, but that's a novel idea to think about how to put the onus back on Congress, because you get the sense from the regulators that they feel betwixt and between in carrying out some of these more novel commands from Congress.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. Sort of unwilling, here, Congress dragooning the agencies, who then eventually become, what is this, Stockholm Syndrome, right? They become to love the kidnappers.
This is Christian. We are right about, we've basically used up all our time. I just want to give, do either of you, Megan or Eric, want to offer any concluding thoughts before we end the call?
No, I look forward to seeing what the on-bank court does, and there'll probably be more commentary to be had after that decision, and we'll see what the Supreme Court, which vehicle gets to the Supreme Court and when to clarify these issues.
I agree. It's going up. It's just a question of when.
Well, then on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank both Megan Brown and Eric Jaffe for joining us today. Thank you also to our audience. A reminder that you can find the audio from this Teleform call, as well as most of our other ones, on our website, as well as the videos from last week's Second Annual Executive Branch Review Conference. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. And please continue to keep calling into our Teleform conference call. So until then, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.